to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm your host, David Zando, a man who was only partly taught to fish, but still managed to feed himself and his family over the years. Curiously, that adage feels somewhat dated or maybe off base. Given how many people fish these days and given the complexities of fisheries, maybe it's not the only rule to follow. I guess it's not really for me to say at this point. Anyway, we will get into many points about fish, fishing, and fisheries this week, and ones that will hopefully get you thinking about what lies beneath our watery surfaces. Before diving in, however, have a listen to this. That was the sound of nature. Nature? Or was it sustainability, circularity, innovation, and the future of localness? It was, in fact, the rumbling of a lot of pisciculture technology in a basement based in an industrial building at the intersection of two autoroutes in central Montreal. It was giant tanks full of thriving, jumping Arctic char, water filtration systems, and oxygenators, feeding machines, and one very clever fish farmer. As you'll hear later on, it was also a lot of relatively common technologies put together with a great idea and a huge investment of time and money. And for now, it seems to be paying off. Anyway, more on that later. As most of us know by now, the state of our planetary fisheries is not great. Factory fishing trawlers, greed, consumer demand, ever-increasing consumer demand, and also, of course, climate change and shifting food webs. All of these things are putting a lot of pressure on our oceans and our seas, our lakes and rivers. Where once our food systems experts told us to shift our consumption focus from mammals to fish, the messages are now a lot more complex. Eat from the center of the fisheries web. Eat only line caught and wild fish. Know your supplier and ask for the provenance of what you buy. Look for labels that say what's sustainable. Like most things foodish, it got complicated, not just complex, and really, really tough for average eaters to figure out what makes sense when it comes to eating fish. At the center of a lot of these messages was the implication that we as consumers need to be more attentive to sustainability. Yet that word is pretty complex itself, and it means different things to different people and different societies. At one point, when I was teaching a course about sustainability in food systems, largely directed at chefs in training, I got a lot of very confused reactions when I started to define the term in the first week of class. For me, as a westernized North American-trained food scholar, the implications of sustainability are pretty fraught, but overall I understand it as engaging in practices that do not have problematic effects for other people, either in other places around the world or within other times in our collective future. However, for a lot of my students, the majority of whom came from places other than Canada, sustainable meant food that you could afford to buy. Affordable now, affordable later, affordable for your family, affordable for your restaurant customers. Whether a food production process had negative effects on the environment or on other people's livelihoods or on the survival of a given food species, none of that was implicated in their understanding of sustainability. It was an eye-opener for me and an important lesson about not assuming too much when it comes to common definitions of certain words. Mostly, it really anchored my own belief that sustainability is not a thing, not a singular objective, but an ongoing process of learning and action. It's a way of being and caring and responding to and interpreting things, and hopefully a way to find points of entry for each of ourselves to participate in the sustainability process ourselves. In any case, as you'll hear in the first conversation of this episode, there's a lot more to think about regarding fishing and fisheries than just the well-being of our natural watery environments, although those are, of course, very important questions as well. Fishing is a beautifully complex subject, a part of many First Nations relationships with the land and waterways, an important livelihood and pastime for individuals and communities worldwide, and the focus of all sorts of trade, regulation, and legal dynamics. It's a very busy and often quite hidden part of our global food systems. Today's guests come from pretty different spaces in the fish world, though, as you'll hear, there are also some pretty impressive overlaps and connections between what they do and how they think. One is a researcher and academic who focuses on, or in fact takes a generalist and systemic approach to, how humans and fisheries interrelate. And the other is a second career farmer, a fish farmer, of course, who with his business partner is also imagining and building up a set of pretty innovative relationships through local and ecological production. Then Maxime and I take a dip into the swirling sea of fishy flavors during Stick This In Your Mouth, and we end with an art science academic who responds with aplomb to the food questionnaire. Kicking things off is Dr. Kristen Lowett, a food scholar working in the School of Environmental Studies at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, on the traditional territories of the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabeg. She grew up near the Great Lakes and recently returned to the region after many years in Atlantic Canada. The role of small-scale fisheries in sustainable food systems and food sovereignty is one of her main interests, which also fits in with her broader efforts in doing community-engaged food systems research. Well, hi, Kristen. Thank you so much for being part of the podcast. I'm delighted to have you here in the studio.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Excited to be here.
So I want to dive right into this wonderful, weird, fabulous, complicated subject of fisheries. And we've known so long, well, relatively long, that the commercial fishing industry, like so many food production systems, is not particularly sustainable. And the problem of overfishing has been really well communicated, I think, to most consumers. But there are so many other issues within fisheries as well. Can you tell me about some of the questions that you particularly are interested in that you're studying mm-hmm. right now?
And yeah, I think you're right. You know, we often think about overfishing, about, you know, collapsed fish stocks, declining wild fisheries, which are, you know, certainly, you know, there's issues around that. But there's a whole host of other sorts of questions or ways of also, you know, thinking about fisheries. And so I guess I come at this from more of a, you know, thinking about a sustainability perspective, you know, broadly in terms of human relationships with fisheries, with water, with communities. So there's a bunch of other questions, I think, that, you know, we can also ask and that fisheries, you know, bring to light. So one question I think that comes to my mind is also who can fish, right? And and then where do those catches where are they going? So if we start globally, we know there is a net flow of seafood from global south to global north country, right? So there's inequities globally in this sort of seafood trade, if we want to call it that, which can, you know, disadvantage access to fisheries and food security in, you know, global south countries.
And when you say global south, you're talking about countries where, I mean, we may have in the past said third world or
developing nations.
The countries that are often exploited by more industrialized countries for their labor force, particularly.
Yes. And you know, now in with global fisheries, you know, there are, for instance, you know, European fishing fleets that have preferential access agreements, you know, to fish off the coast of, you know, countries in Africa or so forth. And so globally, if we look at, you know, this kind of fish and seafood trade as a whole, we can see this kind of net flow of seafood to global north countries. You know, if we think about Canada, which is probably where I'll focus sort of, you know, most of my comments because it's the context I'm most familiar with, we can also ask this question, I mean, where is fish going and who is getting to fish? You know, we have across Canada and other, you know, industrialized nations, this sort of grain of the fleet phenomenon, right? Fish harvesters are getting older, much like sort of farmers who are aging. There's a lot of challenges to entry for younger fishers, really, you know, getting a boat, high license costs, capital, quota, all these things. The imposition of market-based regulations, which are making it harder to enter the sector, which has a lot of implications for how fish reaches us, you know, at the other end of that, you know, as consumers or people who want to eat fish in a particular region. So those are some questions. There's also, of course, livelihoods, labor, workers' rights, and fishing and fish processing as well is also really dangerous work. Fish processing especially tends to be a predominantly, you know, female workforce, increasingly temporary foreign workers, and really high rates of occupational illness and injury. So there's a whole host of considerations. And so that's why rather than, you know, thinking about them in silos, okay, there's fish stocks here, and then we've got, you know, people eating fish over here, or there may be some health and safety considerations here. But if we think about all these interconnected steps and processes that fish flows through, moves through, and is transformed, you know, from lake or ocean to plate, it's a way of connecting, I think, some of these, what might seem like kind of disparate.
So, I mean, not to be be punny, but what you're describing now to me is a very fluid system. A lot of different people and things and issues and politics and social patterns, but also technologies and consumer realities that are all swimming around together, sorry again, and that end up creating this ecosystem that is highly complex and impossible to deal with, as you say, in the sort of siloed way, because each of the issues interacts with each of the other issues, like in many food systems, but maybe even more so because of literally the fluidity of fisheries.
Right, literally fish moving also across, you know, borders, which is another dimension of this, right?
Yeah, because fish don't have passports, and fish can't stop at a country's border, even though it may be defined on a map. It doesn't actually, it's not recognized by the fish.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I think the other piece, you know, from a food systems perspective, or interest in food and what people are eating and where it comes from, is that fisheries, I think, are often still overlooked. Sure, you know, so there's some awareness around overfishing. We see some of these sustainability labels in supermarkets, but I don't think we have, you know, local fish movements akin to the way we do local food movements, which really tend to be very agriculture and terrestrial and kind of agrarian focused. I think there's different reasons for this. One of which is, I think, fish and fisheries tend to be kind of in this almost like entrenched natural resource paradigms. You know, we need to manage it to be the most efficient. How many fish, you know, can we catch efficiently? How many do we need to keep? And then this related almost fish as like commodity sort of, you know, how many can we catch and use sort of lens.
Well, so for a long time, we used to think that the oceans were forever going to be replenished with more and more fish. And they're also a bit out of view. We don't, those of us who live inland don't see what's going on in coastal waters particularly. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. But then also this idea that it's just this abundance of fish that are swimming around waiting to be captured and eaten, which is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we have, so in Canada, for example, I mean, long histories of this, you know, certainly it's precisely some of these forces that also displace indigenous fisheries, but it's also given rise to, so now one of the questions I'm really interested in is, what role do maybe fish play in local diets, especially in more coastal or fishing-dependent regions, but also in some contexts, why is it so hard to get local fish, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that, you know, spending time in Newfoundland, I started to ask, you think, oh, well, there must be so much local fish here. And it's not as easy to get as you might think. And a lot of this comes from this entrenched perspective of, you know, fish as commodity for export.
When you say that, you're talking about like food becoming a thing that we produce in order to make money by selling it rather than a thing that we produce in order to eat it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a commodity for export to make money from it, rather than thinking about this as kind of a public good, something that could be part of public food systems embedded in communities, you know, rooted in self-determination.
Right. And you've mentioned now a couple of times who's doing the fishing. Right. And this is certainly a major issue that has been in the news a lot in recent days in Canada, about tensions and conflicts between First Nations and Indigenous fishers and people who are from colonial settler heritage and are also fishing. And this is getting into some really complex territory relating to rights and regulations. And one of your recent projects was actually to co-produce a film on this, a documentary about the fishing practices of the Batchewana First Nation on Anishinaabe Gichigami, which we know in the colonial tongue is Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me a bit about that process and what you learned about those tensions that are ever present and also part of a long history of colonialism in Canada?
Yes, certainly. So a little bit first, I guess, about maybe the project you're referring to, just briefly. So
yes, we should name the film.
So yes, we could absolutely name it. So it is called Lake Superior Helper, Stories from Batchewanung Fisheries. And so it's about, essentially follows Chief Dean Sayers, the former chief of the community at the time that we made the film, through a series of conversations with community members, elders, young fish harvesters, you know, youth, knowledge keepers in the community, around these cultural, political, ecological relationships surrounding their fisheries. So you said they're on the northeast shore of Lake Superior. They have a, you know, a large kind of area of traditional territory from Bawating, see St. Marie, up to Pukisaw. And they've been fishing there for millennia. And, you know, European colonization severely disrupted these practices. But Batchewana First Nation members, they continue to fish, assert their inherent and Aboriginal and treaty rights to do that. And I think one of the main messages from the film, if you're thinking about, you know, respect to these different, you know, jurisdictions and settler and crown law compared to, you know, Indigenous governance, Batchewana First Nation has not, for instance, you know, taken a license from the province of Ontario to fish. So, you know, we're asserting our laws, our natural law, Indigenous governance here as sort of primary, and then we will share the fish in the lake with others, right? But they're going to come to our table, right? So it's a really good question. And of course, I think there are also big questions about crown law, indigenous governance and jurisdiction, you know, and natural law, and really having to find space and recognize indigenous governance within our Western legal traditions.
Right.
So the film project you referred to emerged out of a process of relationship building over several years with myself and my colleague Charles Lovko at Lakehead University, the former Chief Dean Sayers of the community. And the community really expressed an interest in making a film. So, you know, we want to share a story. We want to, you know, have our voices heard on this. And so we were fortunate to secure a grant to work with the documentary filmmaker, Sarah Furlot from Thunder Bay. We did the filming in June 2019, luckily before the pandemic, which, you know, wasn't a view at that point. And now the film is available. We have a distributor, Collective Eye Films.
Great.
Batchwinonfish.ca is, you know, the website if folks want to
great.
Check it out.
All the links will be in the show notes, so everyone will be able to find it. Good. And for you as participant, but also sort of facilitator of this film production process, although it wasn't your story that you were telling, you were enabling the story to become known. And that's also a role that sometimes academics play when working with Indigenous communities or Indigenous community partners to get a story out. Is that immensely a complicated space to hold while you're trying not to talk about someone else's story, but also wanting that story to be known? What was that like for you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, we've reflected a lot, I think, as a group collectively, you know, working on this about partnership-based approaches, what our relationship means, like how to establish that. And we did, you know, before we ever made a film, it took a long time just to, I think, get to know each other, do small things, you know, together, right? And I think with respect to making the film, it is partly that. It's about, you know, what resources or tools could I bring to this that might move forward, you know, this mutual interest and direction. And so, you know, one thing we could do is secure a grant, found a filmmaker who's really versed in kind of storytelling and documentary for social change to do that work. And then, you know, I think it's important to note that Chief Sayers, for example, you know, led the interviews with the community members, really, with the filmmaker, right? They were very narrative in scope. It was really sort of posing a question, letting people speak. So you can really hear from community members in their sort of own word what fishing means to them and their community embeddedness in traditions and, you know, in culture and ceremony.
Yeah. So you were able to each bring something to the project. It just happened to be that you were also making sure that the people whose stories that were being represented were also the people who were telling those stories.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have any favorite aha moments or parts of the film that you think are the most satisfying for you personally?
There's a lot. I mean, I think when I watch it, it might be a little bit different than what you see because we spent quite a bit of time, you know, with members of the community and like driving around in the car with, you know, Chief Sayers taking us to the territory and explaining things. And you see some of that in the film, right? So I think for me, it was also just this big process of learning and then also like unlearning my own education about this region and all the things I did not know, right? So, you know, I didn't grow up in Sault Ste. Marie exactly, but my family has a cottage, you know, towards Sudbury. But this was a whole other, I realized how much like so many history and stories and peoples are obscured within, you know, the sorts of dominant history I'm used to or have been taught. So it was a big process of, I'd say, learning and kind of unlearning for me, like just through the process of making the film and having these conversations.
Yeah. Wow. With all that you know and all that you do and all the perspectives you've gathered and all the people you've talked to about fisheries, and putting on sort of a pair of speculative eyeglasses for a moment or gazing into the future, do you see possibilities for resolving some of the major tensions that exist between, for example, federal governmental legislation and traditional fishing rights and practices? Is there a way that we can get to some kind of harmony?
Well, I think there are existing documents and places we can look to support. So, for example, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples or the Truth and Reconciliation Commission reports, you know, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Report. Like those are declarations by Indigenous peoples that are upholding some of the principles that I think we need to collectively aspire to. So I think there's a lot there to start with. And I think it also applies to fisheries, taking those forward in these documents developed by, you know, Indigenous peoples.
And so for us as eaters too, just remembering that when we're chomping into a piece of halibut or a salmon or lake trout or Arctic char, we're actually part of that system and that it's part of our responsibility to be maybe better educated, better informed about where a fish is coming from, who did the fishing, who did the processing, who did the shipping, who did all of the stuff that you just talked about, and who's doing the regulating and who's not in charge of regulating things. Is that something that we should be taking on as eaters?
I think we certainly ask the questions. Like, I don't think, you know, I'm not in favor of, you know, everything comes down to just consumer choice because it's very individualistic, But I think in terms of asking some of those critical questions so we can engage in bigger conversations, inform policy, become advocates, become allies, like those are the sorts of things that I think we need to do. And it can start with what's on your plate, right? If you start to ask for that complexity of questions that you just highlighted.
And of course, obviously, we're not, as consumers, I don't believe in the idea of voting with your consumer dollar. That sort of neoliberal stuff is clearly not successful and not a good approach. But becoming more aware and engaging, as you say, posing questions and not blindly assuming that you have the right to this particular thing that's on your plate, whether it's fish or something else. Because it feels like, do we have any control or power as consumers when it comes to what's on in the supermarkets or in the fish stores? Yeah. Not so much. But can we ask some questions and can we help others learn more? And can we push our governments to be better citizens or better relationship builders with other people? Maybe that's where we go. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I hope there's some solution finding in the future, even if it's not sort of easy solutions.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and I think that's, you know, to the point of your podcast and sending food, like that's why food can be so powerful because it is so intimate. We eat it at least, you know, 3 times or more a day for most of us. And so it's a great lens into these questions. It's something we can relate to. And so I think it's a good way of starting, including with fish.
Well, thank you so much for helping to clarify or at least complexify some of these complex and not so clear questions, but I appreciate your time and I'm really glad to have the chance to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And of course, check out the show notes for more information about the documentary film that Kristen discussed, Lake Superior, Our Helper. There's also a link to the trailer to hear the voices of the film participants themselves. Coming up next, we hear from Nicolas Paquin, co-founder of the urban fish farm Opercule, which is situated in a basement suite of the Centrale Agricole in Montreal. Centrale is a cooperative of urban agriculture practitioners, all focused on creating innovative food businesses based on the concept of a circular economy. With his partner, David Dupol-Chiquan, Nicolas conceived, designed, built, and now runs Opercule, which supplies fresh, local Arctic char to numerous restaurants and grocers in Montreal. And their deliveries are mostly made by electric bicycle. This is no offshore fish farm creating problems in coastal ecosystems, and at the relatively small scale at which they operate, Opercule is definitely an intriguing experiment in thinking anew about the meaning of sustainable.
Bon, mais merci Nicolas d'être ici, merci de participer au balado. Je suis super content d'être chez vous à Opercule, ici à Montréal, et bienvenue.
Merci.
Donc, toi, tu es un des deux fondateurs de cette opération d'élevage de poissons. Peux-tu me parler un peu des origines d'Opercule et comment vous l'avez réalisé comme entreprise?
Oui, c'est ça. Comme on est deux personnes qui ont parti ça. Il y a David Dupol-Chiquan, puis il y a moi, Nicole Paquin, dans le fond. David et moi, on était les deux en réorientation de carrière. David, c'est un musicien. Moi, dans mon ancienne vie, j'étais ingénieur mécanique. On a décidé les deux qu'on voulait se lancer dans l'élevage de poissons.
Wow.
Donc, on s'est rencontrés à l'école, à l'EPAC, l'École des pêches et d'aquaculture du Québec. C'est un programme qui se donne en Gaspésie. Et puis, il fallait qu'on voyager pour se rendre jusqu'en Gaspésie pour faire des présentiels. Donc, on s'est rencontrés justement dans l'auto pour monter en Gaspésie.
Mais vous êtes des Montréalais?
Ben, moi, je suis un gars de Québec à la base. J'avais déménagé à Montréal pour la job. Finalement, je suis resté. Lui, c'était un Montréalais, justement.
Et puis, le programme, ça a duré combien de temps?
On a fait un an. Du programme. Okay, okay. En tant que tel, c'est une technique qui dure 3 ans, mais on a fait juste un AEC, attestation d'études collégiales pour l'élevage de poissons d'eau douce.
Cool, cool. Et donc, Opercule s'est installé ici au Centrale Agricole à quelle date?
2019, avril 2019. Mm-hmm. Mais je veux dire, entre l'école puis avril 2019, il y a quand même eu pas mal de choses qui se sont passées.
Ouais.
Le projet qu'on a ici, c'est un système en recirculation. Ce qui veut dire, c'est qu'on réutilise l'eau à 99,5%.
Wow.
Puis c'est un système qui est le seul comme ça de l'œuvre jusqu'à la table au Québec. Donc, il fallait être sûr qu'on était capable de le faire.
Mm-hmm.
Donc, on a fait un système, un projet pilote dans le fond, dans le garage de David, dans son bloc appartement de
Parfait, comme
de Villeray.
Comme tout projet.
Exactement. Donc, on a fait un petit système dans le garage. On a été capable de faire un élevage d'à peu près 750 kilos de poissons. Puis là, on a montré comme, hey, on est capable de le faire, ça marche bien, on sait qu'est-ce qu'on fait. Après ça, on a trouvé le local ici. Puis on a commencé à parler avec tous les ministères pour réussir à avoir nos permis pour faire l'élevage ici.
Oui, j'imagine que la bureaucratie a duré pas mal longtemps.
Ça a duré 2 ans environ.
Wow. Okay.
À avoir tous les permis. On a eu besoin d'avoir des permis avec le MFFP, le ministère de la Faune et de la Flore du Québec, avec le MELCC, le ministère de l'Environnement et de la lutte contre les changements climatiques, avec le MAPAC, avec la ville aussi. Fait que ça a pris à peu près 2 ans pour avoir tous les permis, avoir le financement.
Wow. C'est beaucoup pour lancer une ferme.
Ouais. Oh oui, parce qu'après tout ça, ben il faut faire la construction, puis il faut faire grandir le poisson qui prend aussi un autre 15 mois. Donc, entre le moment qu'on est venu ici en avril 2019, on a commencé à vendre du poisson en février 2023.
Donc, c'est beaucoup d'investissement de temps, mais aussi d'argent pendant un bon bout de temps.
Ben oui, il fallait payer le loyer pendant tout ce temps-là.
Ouais, ouais.
Parce que pour faire des demandes de permis, on avait besoin d'avoir une position géographique pour faire toutes les demandes. Donc, c'est pas juste on fait une demande dans le vide et puis on espère avoir de quoi puis trouver un local après. Il faut se commettre dès le début pour réussir à faire ça. Donc, c'est un bon 5 ans de temps.
Et tu viens de me montrer les installations ici dans le sous-sol de la centrale. C'est pas mal impressionnant. C'est compact, je dirais, mais c'est aussi très technologique. Peux-tu me décrire un peu le système?
Pour rendre ça le plus simple possible, c'est comme un gros aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
On n'a pas inventé aucune nouvelle technologie. On fait juste appliquer de la technologie qui est connue puis à plus grosse échelle. En tant que tel, on a un film mécanique. Fait que ça enlève toutes les matières en suspension dans l'eau. Comme mettons, pour faire une analogie aquarium, ça serait comme une éponge qui enlève tout ce qui est dans l'eau. Ensuite de ça, on a des fils biologiques qui transforment l'ammoniac en nitrite puis après ça en nitrate. Donc ça, c'est justement comme le média filtrant, comme les roches, ces affaires-là qu'on pourrait avoir dans un aquarium. Après ça, ben on a des parties qui sont un petit peu plus comme technologiques. On a un filtre UV pour faire la désinfection. Et après ça, on injecte de l'oxygène pur dans l'eau pour retourner ça au poisson. Mais en tant que tel, c'est juste un gros aquarium qu'on a.
OK. Donc, ça crée effectivement presque le même environnement qui existerait dans la nature à l'extérieur.
Oui.
Une grosse bâtisse à côté de notre route.
Exactement.
Et donc, vous avez choisi cet endroit, la centrale agricole ici à Montréal, à côté de l'autoroute, dans un sous-sol. Pourquoi faire ça en ville?
Il y a plusieurs avantages. On est proche du marché.
Mm-hmm.
On vend directement comme aux restaurateurs ou à des épiceries. Donc, on n'a pas besoin de passer par des grossistes ou bien des transformateurs. Donc, ça nous permet d'avoir des meilleures marges sur notre poisson. Mais ces marges-là, bien, on les réinvestit dans d'autres parties pour être plus éco-responsables. Donc, on utilise des boîtes de carton recyclable au lieu d'avoir du styrofoam qui n'est pas recyclable. Ça engendre des coûts, mais vu qu'on est proche du marché, on peut se le permettre. Aussi, ben, en étant proche du marché, ben, on sait qu'est-ce qui fonctionne, on sait qu'est-ce que les chefs, à quoi ils s'attendent. On a des chefs qui veulent avoir du poisson de 500 grammes, on a des chefs qui veulent avoir du poisson de 2 kilos, puis on est capable de leur fournir.
Mm-hmm.
Mais quand on était à l'école, tout le monde nous disait, essayez d'avoir une grosseur standard. Essayez tout le temps à vendre du poisson de, mettons, 750 grammes ou 1,2 kilos, parce que c'est ça les standards, c'est ça les barquettes, c'est ça que le monde veut. Mais on se rend compte que finalement, non, c'est pas ça que le monde veut.
Ouais. Et parce que c'est un marché des restaurateurs, tu peux aussi inviter les chefs à venir visiter l'installation et pour voir exactement d'où vient leur poisson.
Non, c'est ça exactement. Comme chaque fois qu'on commence à travailler avec un chef, on les invite tout le temps à venir voir. Il y en a qui viennent, il y en a d'autres qui ne viennent pas. Mais c'est quelque chose qu'un des chefs nous disait. Ils ont des contacts avec leur producteur de champignons, leur producteur de verdurettes, leur producteur de bœuf, mais le poisson, c'est comme tout le temps un air de « je vais passer ça à un grossiste puis j'ai aucune idée d'où c'est que ça vient
».
Comme mettons, dans notre chaîne de production, on fait les commandes les lundis. Donc, les chefs nous passent les commandes les lundis. On fait les abattages les mardis. On fait la livraison le mercredi. Le jeudi, on a quasiment plus de poisson dans notre chambre froide. Donc, c'est vraiment les chefs nous commandent, puis on leur livre la semaine même.
C'est très frais et très peu de gaspillage.
Très peu de gaspillage. Alors, on fait vraiment juste l'abattage de qu'est-ce qui a été vendu déjà. Donc, on n'a pas de surplus de poissons.
Donc, c'est très soigneux tout ce que vous faites et même au niveau de livraison que vous faites en vélo électrique.
Oui,
c'est ça.
Okay. Vélo électrique, on fait affaire avec une compagnie La Roue Libre qui font pas mal toutes leurs livraisons à vélo électrique ou sinon en véhicule électrique. Parce que c'est ça, on est proche du marché, on peut se le permettre. Ça engendre des coûts pareils, mais c'est quelque chose qu'on pense qui doit être fait. On veut pas juste faire comme les autres, on veut penser à comment ça devrait être fait, puis montrer que ça peut être fait comme ça.
Mm-hmm. Donc, il y a un plan d'affaires, il y a un plan de durabilité, il y a un plan d'éthique, il y a un plan culturel? Est-ce que c'est tout le même plan ou est-ce que vous avez pensé à ces aspects du business en différentes manières?
Tout est pas mal mélangé ensemble. On a pris la décision au début qu'on voulait être éco-responsable. Fait que le plan d'affaires était fait basé là-dessus. Comme mettons, on aurait pu décider d'avoir du poisson qui est organique ou biologique. Mm-hmm. On a décidé de pas faire ça. On a décidé d'aller dans le plus éco-responsabilité. Les boîtes de carton recyclables, ça coûte plus cher, mais on pensait que c'était la bonne affaire à faire. Livraison en véhicule électrique, c'était la bonne chose aussi. Puis on prend tout le temps les décisions basées là-dessus aussi.
Donc, l'opération est renommée pour son empreinte environnementale très légère. Qu'est-ce que vous faites ici qui est tellement différent des autres éleveurs de poissons?
Une des grosses différences qu'on a, c'est notre système qui est en recirculation. Bien, il y a plusieurs types de systèmes traditionnels en élevage. Il y a les cages en mer, que tout le monde connaît, comme pour les saumons, qui sont quand même pas tant éco-responsables que ça, à cause de leur nature. Il y a l'élevage en milieu terrestre, donc du monde qui aurait des bassins ou des étangs, prendrait de l'eau de la nappe phréatique ou bien d'une rivière, passerait dans le système, et puis après ça, il le retourne dans l'environnement. Nous, on fait de la recirculation d'eau. Donc, l'eau, on la rend dans le système et on la retourne, on la traite, on la retourne aux poissons. Donc, on utilise à peu près un 14 litres minute d'eau, ce qui représente 100 à 200 fois moins d'eau qu'une pisciculture traditionnelle. Ouais, aussi, vu qu'on est à Montréal, ben, on utilise l'eau de la ville de Montréal, qui est exempte de pathogènes, et on utilise aussi l'égout de la ville de Montréal. Mm. Donc, on retourne ça à l'usine d'épuration de la ville de Montréal avant de le retourner dans le milieu naturel. Notre système est comme en parallèle un peu comme de l'environnement. Donc, on n'a pas un gros impact là-dessus.
Donc, même si nous sommes dans une grosse bâtisse industrielle, c'est plus ou moins la nature que vous avez reproduit dans ce sol ici.
Oh, oui. Puis aussi, vu qu'on est à l'intérieur, ça nous permet d'être sans maladie. Mm-hmm. Donc, on n'utilise pas d'hormones, pas d'antibiotiques, pas de produits chimiques pour faire les traitements sur les poissons. L'eau de la ville est certifiée, ben, pas certifiée, mais est considérée comme exemple de pathogène. Il n'y a pas de poissons de l'environnement qui peut venir nous voir. Nos poissons, ils ne peuvent pas aller voir l'environnement non plus. Donc, c'est vraiment comme une petite bulle.
Oui, oui, oui. Isolée et protégée, mais aussi très sain.
Oui.
Moi, j'ai eu la chance récemment de manger de votre humble chevalier au resto Autain, ici à Montréal. Comment, toi, tu décris le goût et la texture de votre produit?
C'est l'humble chevalier, c'est dans la même famille que les saumons, les truites. Mmh. Donc, ça a pas mal le même profil de goût. Mais pour moi, je le trouve beaucoup plus délicat. Le saumon, je ne suis pas un gros fan parce que je trouve que le goût, il te frappe dans la face. C'est comme intense, c'est comme « Salut, je suis un saumon ». L'homme chevalier, c'est le fun, c'est doux. Je l'ai mangé en fumée aussi, comme c'est super délicat, c'est le fun. Fait que toutes, pas mal les recettes qui peuvent être faites avec du saumon, de la truite, ils peuvent être faites aussi avec l'homme chevalier. Il faut juste comme ajuster un peu les épices pour ne pas cacher le poisson derrière dans le fond. Ouais.
Est-ce que toi, tu en manges souvent?
J'en mange relativement souvent, oui. Comme mettons, les poissons qui sont pas vendus la semaine, ben souvent, ben, ils vont finir dans mon frigo ou ces choses-là. Mm-hmm. Mais oui, non, j'en mange de temps en temps. Pour moi, la façon préférée que je fais des filets. Mm-hmm. Après ça, je le fais cuire côté de la peau dans la poêle avec du beurre puis de l'huile. Je mets un couvercle sur le dessus pour faire cuire le dessus par la vapeur. Et après ça, je fais une sauce grébiche.
Mm-hmm. C'est classique. Oui, puis tu peux goûter exactement le poisson plutôt que la sauce.
Exactement. Ouais. Là, c'est peut-être bien avec des asperges, la sauce grébiche aussi, ces asperges, c'est comme... c'est vraiment bon.
Ouais, j'imagine.
Mais tu sais, je fais tout le temps des tests aussi, comme je l'ai fait cuire dans une croûte de sel, du tartare, comme du char tartare. C'est quand même
char
assez...
tartare.
C'est quand même assez bon. Sinon, ben, quand on va au restaurant, ben, ils nous font tout le temps des affaires un petit peu spéciales. Souvent, comme justement, les restaurants vont nous taguer dans leurs posts Instagram. Mm. Fait qu'on voit toutes leurs idées qu'ils ont eues.
Donc, à cause de profils que vous avez déjà reçus dans les médias et puis à cause du fait que vous avez maintenant plusieurs restos qui servent votre poisson, est-ce qu'il y a une demande des consommateurs de faire des ventes directes?
Il y a beaucoup de monde qui nous le demande. Malheureusement, on n'est pas équipé pour ça. Mm-hmm. C'est comme les livraisons, on les fait le mercredi, mais c'est une journée quand même assez intense.
Ouais.
J'ai pas le temps, le staff ou l'espace pour que le monde puisse juste venir cogner et dire « Hey, je voudrais avoir deux poissons ». Par contre, on fait affaire avec des épiceries, comme les GA du chemin à Ville-Saint-Laurent, ils ont notre poisson. Ah, okay. Il y a certains métros qui ont notre poisson aussi. Comme en théorie, sur toute l'île de Montréal, les métros peuvent commander notre poisson. Donc, si vous voulez goûter, vous pouvez aller voir votre poissonnier métro dire « Hey, je voudrais avoir du poisson percule. Okay, on est un de leurs distributeurs.
Parfait, je sais exactement ce que je vais faire demain.
Ouais. sinon, ben c'est ça, les jeux du chemin, il y en a aussi. On fait affaire des fois avec le conserva sur rue Saint-Hubert. Si vous voulez avoir de l'ombre fumée, il y a certaines épiceries qui l'offrent.
Good.
Ouais.
Je vais aller m'en chercher. Donc, comme j'ai mentionné au début de la conversation, Opercule s'est situé dans un sous-sol dans la centrale agricole, une grande coopérative agriculture urbaine à Montréal. Et la bâtisse héberge une vingtaine d'autres producteurs et d'acteurs du secteur agroalimentaire. Il y a un concept plus large ici à la centrale, c'est d'explorer et d'innover avec l'économie circulaire.
C'est ça. Dans le fond, la centrale agricole a commencé en 2019. Mm-hmm. Opercule est un des membres fondateurs de la centrale agricole. Donc, j'ai personnellement signé les lettres patentes de la centrale agricole. Depuis ce temps-là, ça a quand même beaucoup évolué. On a commencé à 5 entreprises. Maintenant, on est rendu à 19 entreprises. Il y a des torréfacteurs de café, du monde qui font de la déshydratation, comme du Nord, qui font de la revalorisation d'invendables. Il y a Improve qui font aussi sécurité alimentaire. Mm-hmm. Il y a des producteurs d'insectes pour la consommation, si c'est quelque chose qui vous intéresse.
Oui.
Il y a cidre, du vin, puis beaucoup d'éverdurettes aussi. Donc, il y a quand même une belle énergie qui se passe ici, des projets vraiment innovateurs qui se passent ici. Mais pour venir à Centrale, pour être une entreprise qui vient ici, il faut avoir des idées de collaborer avec le monde. Comme là, physiquement ici, on est dans le local de Torréfaction Québec, qui est le torréfacteur. Eux, ils ont des rejets qui vont donner à ça une champignonnière, qui vont finir par faire des micro-matériaux qui sont utilisés pour faire le comptoir sur lequel qu'on est.
Wow! Donc, c'est une surface en champignons qu'on voit avec des epoxy là-dessus, mais c'est vraiment, c'est super cool et c'est circulaire.
C'est ça. Sinon, les champignons qu'eux autres ne sont pas vendus, ils sont transférés à la Compagnie du Nord pour faire leur risotto de champignons.
Mm.
Moi, de mon côté, je produis CO2 qui pourrait être utilisé justement pour faire pousser la verdurette ou utilisé aussi pour les champignons pour certains de leurs procédés. J'ai de l'eau qui est remplie de nutriments qui peut être transformée en engrais, justement pour faire la culture hydroponique. Donc, tu sais, il y a beaucoup d'idées qui se passent ici, il y a beaucoup d'opportunités. Puis le monde sont beaucoup focusés sur l'innovation aussi.
Ouais, donc j'imagine que si tu décides de s'installer ici, c'est une question non seulement de faire une production, mais de faire partie d'une communauté, de participer à l'innovation au niveau des idées, non seulement au niveau des
produits. C'est même un prérequis.
Ouais.
Si tu penses venir ici puis être dans ton coin puis pas participer à vie commune parce qu'on est une coopérative, c'est pas voulu.
Ouais, parfait. Oui. Donc, c'est un modèle aussi pour nous autres qui existent dans le monde à l'extérieur de l'agricole pour penser vraiment plutôt à participer, à collaborer, à s'échanger avec.
Mais c'est ça, comme tous les déchets qu'on produit, il y a beaucoup de monde qui peuvent les réutiliser. Puis le monde ne sont juste pas au courant que ça existe ou qu'il n'y a pas cette opportunité-là.
Ouais.
Mes extraits peuvent être l'extrait d'une autre entreprise.
Ouais.
Donc, si je suis capable de me débarrasser de mes extraits en les donnant à quelqu'un d'autre, qu'ils soient revalorisés, réutilisés, je veux dire, tout le monde est gagnant en bout de ligne.
Absolument. Ouais. Donc, question finale. Opercule,
oui.
Si je ne me trompe pas, sont les plaques osseuses qui font fermer et ouvrir les ouïes des poissons. Est-ce que c'est
ça? Les plaques osseuses qui protègent les branchies, oui.
Voilà. OK. Donc, pourquoi nommer l'opération Opercule?
Premièrement, félicitations, tu es la première personne qui comprend c'est quoi le nom d'opercule et où tu sais que ça vient.
Okay.
Je suis tout le temps obligé d'expliquer que c'est les plaques osseuses sur les branchies. Pourquoi opercule? On cherchait un nom. Ah. On a commencé à réfléchir à tous les noms possibles et imaginables. Pendant un bout de temps, on cherchait comme la pisciculture. Puis là, j'ai une barbe, David avait une barbe, là, c'est la pisciculture des barbus, pisciculture de telle affaire, telle autre chose. Puis à un moment donné, comme on a commencé à nommer les noms des parties du poisson, puis on est arrivé sur opercule. Puis on a fait comme, ah, opercule, c'est propre, c'est un beau nom, ouais. Ça sonne bien, ça dit qu'est-ce que ça dit. OK, opercule.
OK, quand j'ai compris ce que ça veut dire, j'ai pensé, OK, donc c'est un système mécanique qui fait ouvrir quelque chose.
On n'est pas allé aussi loin que ça. C'est vraiment juste une partie de poisson, ça sonnait bien.
C'est un beau nom, oui.
C'est ça.
C'est mémorable aussi. Tout ce que vous faites est mémorable et je suis tellement content de les rencontrer, de la mieux connaître. Merci beaucoup, Nicolas, pour avoir participé au podcast.
Bien, merci de m'avoir invité au podcast.
To learn more about Opercule and see some images of how they operate, go to the show notes for this episode where I've linked to their website and Instagram. There's also an English language transcript available in case you didn't catch all the conversation in French.
What's going on? There's something fishy. Oh, it's because we're doing a
Fish edition of Stick This in Your Mouth. Here we go. So, Maxim, we're going to taste some fish today. What do you think of that?
I usually like fish.
Yeah. Well, and you told me that your father was a fisher and you grew up with fresh fish coming into your kitchen.
Yes.
What kind of fish were they?
Lots of salmon, lots of trout.
Mm-hmm. River trout, lake trout?
River trout. Because you would go to Matane.
Matane in the Gaspésie?
Yes. And then also doré. I don't know what doré is in
English. Oh, yeah. We looked this up recently. Yes. Hey, listeners, look up doré for us and
send it. And let us know. Let us know. In the comments.
Okay. What do you think about fish today?
In what regard?
What are your feelings about eating fish today?
I love fish. I'm open to eating it raw, like, you know, sushi, sashimi, or... what is it?
Cooked.
or cooked as well, of course.
Well, and we don't eat that much fish, do we?
No, we do not.
We eat salmon, farmed salmon, because that's all we can get here in Montreal, unless we're going to the very expensive fish stores, in which case it is so unaffordable that it stops being pleasant to eat.
There you go.
And it's a bummer.
It is, because it's so good.
Yeah, and there used to be fish shops in Montreal, and they've just kind of evaporated. There's like two.
Which is really unfortunate, and we do not have one close by in our neck of the wood in Montreal.
So. No. So, I mean, I remember I used to eat a lot of like frozen tilapia fillets and stuff like that.
Same and here in Seoul.
But the stories about farmed fish made me so disgusted that I just don't want to eat it anymore.
Well, we've been told some of the fishing is not responsible or there's mercury in the fish or something like that. So it's a little...
A little discouraging.
Yes.
So today we're going to dive straight into the discouragement factor of what's going on with fish these days by eating from the top of the food chain and not quite from the bottom, but also from close to the bottom. Actually, we're going to eat some more sustainable fish and some much less sustainable fish. How does that grab you?
Well, let's try them.
Okay. So the first one's tuna.
Yes.
Pretty much top of the food chain in the fisheries world. And so much history of do eat this tuna, don't eat that tuna, eat tuna, don't eat tuna. It's a complicated fish. Yes. And it's also such a central fish to so many different diets, particularly in Japan. It's a very highly prized fish. We don't eat that much whole tuna. We eat a lot of canned tuna these days.
Yes.
Not a lot, but sometimes.
Yep.
On our salade niçoise. So this time we've got a pâté de thon, like a tuna spread that I just found at our grocery store. I thought, let's try that out. And it makes me feel a little less bad because it's actually tuna, but it's looking at the ingredients. It's like potatoes and oil and onion and a few other ingredients. It actually seems pretty well made. It's an Italian brand. It's like tuna, but spread out with a lot of potatoes and oil. So it's less harmful to the environment. I don't know. Anyway, we'll see. So I've got spread on a little crouton here.
Thank you.
It's kind of pale pink.
Yep.
What is it? How excited are you to eat some tuna pate?
Well, it smells like tuna.
Looks like paste. It doesn't taste like too much.
It's a faint taste.
Yeah. It's like the idea of tuna. It's not bad.
It's not bad. It's just, there is an aftertaste.
A retro olfactory effect.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm getting a kind of tinny aftertaste.
Yeah.
Tempting.
Mm-hmm. I'm also tasting a lot of lemon.
Yeah, it's a bit lemon pledgy. It's not like fresh lemon.
Explain the concept of lemon pledgy, please.
No, you do, please.
Listener, a friend of mine said...
Shout out to Jean-Marc.
Said to me at one point, it's lemony, but it doesn't taste like pledge. And I was laughing on the floor. And then it's been the mystery ever since as to why he thinks...
This was a dessert, right?
Yes.
This
was a cookie, like a lemon cookie.
Well, let's move on to gustatory delight number two.
Yes.
Which you're not going to be happy about.
No, I'm not going to be happy about this one.
Anchovies. When I was a kid, my sister loved anchovies on pizza, and I found them disgusting because by the time you cooked an anchovy in a pizza oven, it kind of turns into just a lot of bones and oil. Your face is priceless right now. Mm-hmm. Wish this was video. However, when I was living in Italy, I really came to appreciate anchovies a lot because there's so many different kinds of anchovies. There are salt-cured anchovies and oil-cured anchovies. There are white anchovies. There are brown anchovies. There are anchovies in vinegar. There are anchovies in oil. And it's just like the range of anchovies outside of the North American context is pretty. I mean, I did try to find some white anchovies because I think you would like them more. They taste more like small fillets of fish rather than little bony brown things. And so how are you feeling right now?
What are those?
So they're salt cured in oil, and they're kind of regular brown anchovies.
Okay.
So why do you, before you taste it, why do you not like anchovies?
Because I've tasted it before. I used to make a recipe that called for it. I used to add it, and there's this lingering taste. It's a very particular taste, and it's very fishy. And it's just... And it's also, it's not to my liking.
Okay. But is it the boniness or is it the tastiness?
It's the tastiness.
Okay. Just on a note, fishy.
Yes.
Listeners, if your fish smells fishy, it's not fresh.
Yes.
Fish doesn't smell fishy.
No.
Fish doesn't taste fishy unless it's a little too old to be eaten. So that whole, like, I don't like fish because it smells like fish. Well, then you shouldn't be eating it because it's probably not very fresh. Mm-hmm. All right. Here we go with the anchovy.
No, it's not so bad, this one.
Yum. I love them.
This is a better one.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's in a jar and not a can. So maybe there's a little bit less metallic taste coming through.
Probably.
So what are you getting now in your mouth as you've swallowed that bit of anchovy on toast?
Mix of fish taste and brine.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's a little difficult to explain. There's a bit of umami taste.
Umami and salty.
Yeah.
Well, that's why they're so good. I mean, anchovies are what gets turned into fish sauce or various types of things like anchovies. It's a wonderful seasoning. It's a wonderful additive to lots of other dishes. The nice thing about anchovies is if you chop them up small, they sort of just melt into, you know, a pasta sauce or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So next time I will try to find some white anchovies because I think you might find them even more pleasant.
Oh.
And so, yeah, as I said at the beginning, one of the reasons I wanted to try some tuna and some anchovies is tuna's at the top of the fish chain. And anchovies are actually kind of in the middle. So things like anchovies, sardines, herring, mackerel, these are great fish to eat because they reproduce quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They are relatively sustainable in terms of being caught and eaten. They taste great. They're full of good oils, so they're really good for your body.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of a nice sweet spot for eating fish if we are still going to keep eating fish in a semi-responsible way. And that's why I like, I mean, it's one of the reasons I like anchovies is that they taste good, but they also taste good in the mind. Yes. I don't feel like I'm doing damage to the world. Same thing with sardines and mackerel. And that's why I eat a lot of tinned fish, or I used to eat a lot of tinned fish before I met you. Just because it feels like it's a way to eat fish without, you know, destroying the top end of the, the fish web.
Well, thank you for this delicious tasting of fishes.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for participating. And may you have a very not fishy day.
We'll try.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
When I first started doing my PhD coursework on food systems and ecogastronomy, I came across a very cool academic article by Marianne Lean and John Law about the weirdnesses of salmon farming in the Atlantic. The two are good storytellers, so despite dealing with some pretty lofty themes related to human and environmental systems, the article was a great read and kicked off a line of thinking in my own head about how fluid all food systems are, and not just aquatic ones. Of course, when it comes to fisheries, and as Kristen pointed out in our conversation, the political boundaries we establish on maps are often not that important. More, it's how things move and relate to each other, whether we're talking about fish and water currents and nets, or people and conservation policies and pisciculture permits. One of the things that sticks with me so much from the Lean and Law article is how the practice of farming salmon gave rise to a new way of understanding the non-farmed version of salmon. In other words, wild salmon. In more other words, wild salmon never actually existed before people started farming salmon. They were just salmon. They weren't wild because there was no such thing as farmed. So their wildness only came about because another kind of fish had been created, ones that weren't wild. You create a new concept and suddenly the opposite of that concept also becomes a thing. So wild salmon only really exists because of humanity's interventions in the fishing ecosystem. It's a pretty effective illustration of the fluidity of fisheries and their changeability and also the unpredictability of outcomes when people start trying to control or manage nature. As a kind of parallel to wild salmon, the concept of sustainability also has emerged because of our all too human ways of being that are just not sustainable. If we never started overfishing or colonizing or exploiting other places and their people, the notion of sustainability might never have crept into our vocabulary. To paraphrase the immortal drag expression, if you stay sustainable, you ain't gotta get sustainable. So this all kind of brings us back to where we started, including the challenges we face as individuals to be part of more enduring food systems. Maybe there's some useful options in the systems that Nicolas Paquin and Opercule are developing, and maybe that's a pathway towards greater sustainability. Or if you prefer to stay away from the S word, maybe you want to think and act in ways that support other systemic betterness, things like resilience or ecosophy or responsibility, care, attentiveness, agroecology, or just simply balance. There are plenty of good ways to be to choose from. And whatever you call it, it's ultimately about honoring and nurturing relationships and not simply assuming that everything is going to be available to us, whether or not we take care of the worlds we inhabit. Jumping out of the frying pan for the moment, though hopefully not into the fire, let us turn our attention to the food questionnaire. This week, it's with Christy Spackman. Christy is an assistant professor at Arizona State University with a joint appointment in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society and the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering. She runs the Sensory Laboratory there, a research creation collective that explores ways to disrupt the status quo of how institutions and infrastructures make sense of sensing. Her recent book, The Taste of Water, is about the work done to reduce the perceptual markers of place in water over the 21st century. When we recorded her responses to the food questionnaire, Christy described herself as a would-be or former runner, a baker, but not currently, and as a reader.
Christy, what is your idea of a perfect food?
It is absolutely a lovely loaf of crusty, hearth-baked sourdough bread.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
So I previously taught a class called Microbial Geographies. And in that class, students had to practice fermentation all semester long and keep a journal about their process of trying to care for a microbial other. And then at the end of the semester, we had this big feast where people brought a sample of their fermented food to share. And it turned out that I don't always trust my students to safely shepherd microbes through the fermentation process. So fermented foods from people that I know perhaps too well.
What food or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Capacious.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Profit motive.
Which food person do you most admire?
Scott Barton. He's a colleague of mine from my graduate work at NYU who used to work in the food world as a chef and now is an amazing scholar slash creator.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Lab-grown meat.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
On the most basic level, it's bread and cheese. And on a more once-in-a-moon level, it was eating at the El Bulli retrospective menu at Next in 2012. When I was a graduate student, I held a bake sale to finance my going there.
For what do you hunger?
A perfect cup of hot chocolate.
What do you consider to be an overrated food or food context?
This is going to be controversial, but macaroni and cheese and donut shops.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
When someone offers me a low-quality store-baked or from-box baked good.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
I think dinner tables are extremely fraught spaces. They're both my favorite place to be, like with friends or my side of the family, and a side of conflict. And apologies to my husband's side of the family, but the dinner table is definitely a site of conflict for them.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
The crunch of an apple, the slight astringency of an almost ripe banana, and the fact that it's dessert that grows on a tree.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
The melt-in-the-mouth aspects of a perfectly braised, tough cut of meat.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
I'm not really a condiment person per se, but maybe mustard.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
ones with ripe tomatoes in them.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
Okay, so a bit of a background. I trained initially as a chemist, and I absolutely should have the patience to track my baking experiments and choose not to.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
Metabolic slowing.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
I used to know how to glove debone poultry.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
Fennel or mineral water.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
Michel Bras on a foggy evening, and barring that, a Dutch oven dinner with my family while camping.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
It's my Fulteng Sabatier knife that I got for maybe $11 at a discount store before I knew what a good knife even looked like.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Marshmallows. I didn't know that until this year, but it's definitely marshmallows.
What is your favorite aroma?
I'm going to mispronounce this. Apologies to all the French folks. Tourtière, which is a meat pie from Quebec. My family eats it every Christmas morning.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
I almost never use my mandolin, and the Alinea cookbook that's sitting on my shelf has a nice layer of dust on it. That's aspiration cooking, if ever there was such a thing.
Who are your favorite food writers?
I think Deb Perlman of Smitten Kitchen is phenomenal, as is Ruth Reichel.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
All of the folks on The Great British Bake Off and Lionel Poilin.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
Mexican, even though there is no drop of Mexican ancestry anywhere in my body.
What is your most powerful sense?
Smell, especially when I have a migraine.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Trompe and otolice.
What would you eat as your second-to-last meal?
Roasted root veggies, roast chicken, and apple pie.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
Forget cake, eat pie.
And thus ends this fishy and hopefully alluring episode of Making a Meal of It. See what I did there? Dad jokes for everyone. A tip of my fishhook crusted hat to the fluid and fantastic Kristen Lowett, the innovative ideator Nicolas Paquin, the sensitive art scientist Christy Spackman, and of course my pensive pescatarian and carnivore Maxime Giroux. I am sorry I never really picked up fishing as a boy, but hey, somebody's got to stay home and cook the vegetables. There's lots of good bait for you in the show notes this week, and hopefully there's something that will hook you. Let me know where you net out on fishing. Okay, I'm going to stop, I promise. Or just send me a food pun via social media. You know where to find me on the usual platforms. Next week, we turn our attention to the marvelous magic of mushrooms. From foraging to farming to freeing our minds and finding out if the rest will follow. I talk to a mycological market manager here in Montreal, as well as a Mexican mistress of mycelia. And hopefully by then, I will have run out of M words. Join us, won't you? In the meantime, as so many have said before, buon appetito and bete avant.